All right. Well, I mean, welcome to yet another edition of Light Beer, Dark Money. I'm Chris Clements. This is Sean Noble. And we are really blessed and fortunate to have as our guest today, Pastor Frank Switzer of Redemption Arcadia Church. Right. And I've gotten to know Frank over the last, 2 years.
Right.
Principally because a friend of mine named Jim Fersini told me I had to meet Frank when I moved to town. And Frank has been really a pastor to a lot of business people here in town and had a longstanding family business here in town. And he's here to talk to us about whatever he wants to talk about.
Well, I think we talked before Frank got here, and thank you for being here, Frank. I think this will be an interesting conversation.
Is this where I ask for the questions in advance?
Too late.
Yep, okay.
But let's just jump right in.
You want to jump right into the big one?
The big one.
So Frank and I met, we meet for breakfast every once in a while, and right. I think we met at First Watch about 2 months ago.
Yeah,
and we sat down, we ordered our food, and then I basically looked across the table at Frank and I said, okay, with the pandemic, what do you think God's doing?
Yeah, so this is interesting to me because I actually mentioned that in a sermon on a Sunday morning. I didn't use your name, but I mentioned this because generally when pastors meet with people, they're meeting with them to hear about the person's preference and how the church isn't meeting their preference in some area. And so if you remember, I remember this distinctly because it was so out of the norm, so shocking to me. We had talked a little bit and then you looked right at me and you prefaced it much with a lot more. You said, you know, this last year with the pandemic, with the civil unrest, with the election, I mean, it's been a rough year. What do you think God is doing in the midst of this? And if you recall, I just sat back and I didn't say anything for a while. And then I actually told you, I said, I'm just sort of reveling in the moment that somebody would ask me a question like that, that is, I think, more important than what I'm usually sitting around talking to people about. And the answer was, it's several prong. Number one, I think that first of all, in the church, I think that God is sifting and pruning the church. And how he's doing that is all of these things that have combined in the last year have not necessarily built character, but rather revealed a lot of character, and in especially in terms of what our false gods are, what our idols are in our culture today. And what we're finding, unfortunately, is that Jesus is great, wonderful guy, good teacher, filled with compassion and love, but really there are other things that are more important to a lot of people who do attend church and call themselves Christians. And I hope I don't say that in necessarily a critical way, because we're all prone to that. I've got my own false gods too. I've got my own idols as well that I'm constantly having to figure out and push away. These idols, these false gods that get in the way of our relationship with God, but also get in the way of our relationship with others.
Right. You know?
If you think about church conflict and church division, most of the time you can trace it back to somebody's preference for a false god rather than the gospel, and that's where it starts. And so I think God is pruning and sifting the faith community in that way. It's moving people along, moving people out, but it's exposing, it's revealing our false gods and our idols and the things that are temporal, part of this world, that aren't necessarily as important as we think they are. It's not that they're bad things. You know, idols are not necessarily bad things. In fact, usually they're good things. They're just built up into ultimate things, and that's when they become bad things. So I think that's what God is doing, is he's forcing us to examine, do some self-assessment. He's pushing us towards prayer, I would hope, and revealing some of our character to us, things that are there but haven't been on the surface in the past. That's the short answer, believe it or not.
Well, it's a very interesting thought process to go through, because, like, one of the things that I read recently, I think Pew have their, some latest research that talked about church attendance. And for the first time since they've asked the question, fewer than half of Americans attend church on a regular basis. That's concerning. And then I had to look at myself and say, well, lately I've been one of those. You know, the beginning of the pandemic, we would watch church on online, and then we kind of it just kind of fell off. And and so I think it is interesting to see how people have reacted to this, and you definitely can see people going away from God as a result of this, saying, well, how could God let this happen? And I mean, bad things happen all the time, and it's, you know, I said to people, this happens because he's testing us. You know, we have to be able to demonstrate that we can get through tough times. And, you know, thankfully for me and my family, I haven't had any, you know, as a result of the pandemic, there's been no crisis. But you certainly see it in other families.
That kind of thing. Absolutely.
It's been very interesting throughout my life when to hear kind of general Christian talk about the church. It doesn't, it's not necessarily a denomination. It's the faith community, right? And I've always wondered how the faith, the non-Mormon faith community views, because we view ourselves or have viewed ourselves, and I say ourselves, I'm not officially a member right now, but historically as the only true church. And Catholics believe that they're the only true, and then obviously you have the broader church. How does that, does when mainline Christians that are not of Catholic or Mormon faith, how do they view the totality? I guess that's a really vague question, but
it is. If you're speaking about specifically Mormons, I'm not sure. It depends on the on who you talk to, and it depends on what they know about the Mormon Church. And frankly, I have very few of those conversations, not because I don't want to. It just hardly ever comes up. The conversation I do have a lot of is about the relationship between the Catholic and the Protestant Church, which we'd be considered Protestant, Bible Church.
Right.
Not that Catholic isn't a Bible Church, but, you know. That comes up a lot because we have a ton of people who grew up in the Catholic Church or who were formerly Catholic who attend our church. And this is just coming from me and my perception and the conversations that I have. I can't generalize this, but I can tell you what my experience has been. My experience is I think that there's more animosity between the Protestants and Catholics directed from the Protestants to the Catholics than there should be. It's as if many Protestants have forgotten that we grew out of the Catholic Church.
Right.
When we talk about the historical church, that's our church. And so we tend to focus on our differences, and which can be significant and important, and I'm willing to have those hard conversations, but there's also a lot of similarities, and there are a lot of there's a lot of common ground there, and I think those are good conversations that you can have as well. It's funny, I just came out of a premarital session where, again, this came up because I do a lot of premarital where there's one who's kind of grew up in a Protestant or Bible church background, the other one grew up in a Catholic, very, very hard meaning, like every Sunday Catholic, going to Mass every Sunday or Saturday night, and they're getting married, and they're going to do it in our church or in our tradition, and they're having to navigate with their family how that what that's going to look like, and how are we going to honor them during the ceremony and all that. So, yeah, so it's an important conversation.
Interesting.
But were you? So I grew up sort of Heinz 57. I think we've had this conversation. Mm-hmm. So my grandmother was Southern Baptist. My grandfather was evangelical. My mother, her parents were both Catholic and Armenian Apostolic.
Oh, wow.
I was baptized in the Armenian Apostolic Church.
That explains a lot about you, Chris.
So, I mean, if you've ever been to an Armenian Apostolic Church, it is something else. Mm-hmm. With the incense and the whole thing. We used to go to have Easter at the cathedral in Fresno, Arizona. Shout out to people in Fresno who have endured that. But you can't understand a thing they're saying. So I had all these influences. But the greatest influence in my life was my dad's mom, my grandma Pat, who was Southern Baptist through and through. Mm-hmm. Bible. I mean, she bought me Bible comics and things of that nature. Anything that she could to pour into me and to make me understand that it's all about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And I think we forget about that.
Yeah.
You know, and when we start debating church doctrine and we start debating church history, and we don't bring it back to Jesus and what his teachings were, who he was. Andy Stanley has a great book about this called Irresistible, and he talks about the early church. And gosh, if we could just get back to the teachings of the early church, of the way, then we wouldn't worry about all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't worry about, you know, who's in my camp, who's in your camp,
right.
What camp are you in? Because that's how kind of we lead the discussion of religion in our society these days.
Yeah.
Is, well, you know, what religion are you? Mm-hmm. Or my friend Carl Medeiros wrote a great book called Speaking of Jesus. And he has this way of disarming people when people will ask him, well, you're a Christian, right? And he'll say, well, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, right.
Which is true.
Yeah, sure.
It's a really true thing. Like, well, what do you mean by that? Because that moniker, Christian, depending where you are in the world, can be a good thing or a bad thing. If you're in Beirut 20 years ago, not so good.
Yeah.
You know.
And it can mean so many different things.
It can mean so many different things. People. There's a lot that comes with that, obviously with church history and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so how do we bring it back to Jesus?
Well, that's a big question again. Yeah. And again, you're talking about one person trying to do something, but redemption, give you a little background on Redemption Church.
Sure.
We're actually one church with 10 congregations in Arizona.
Mm, okay.
And but we're different than a lot of multi-site or multi-congregational churches in the sense that we don't have piped in preaching from some one person, and then there's a screen that's raised up and you see the same person in all the different locations preaching. So each of our congregations is locally led, local preaching. We're preaching through the same preaching calendar, but we're locally contextualizing what we're saying. So everything is contextualized within the local congregation. We all have our own elder boards, our own staffs, all of that stuff. We have things that are centralized, things that are unified, and then things that are decentralized. So Redemption Arcadia, for some strange reason, probably a lot to do with me, we have a robust, large prison ministry that doesn't necessarily translate to some of the other congregations because that's not what they're gifted in. But so we do things locally, but we also have things that are centralized and unified. So one church, 10 congregations. And then we say this. We are gospel-centered and outward-focused. So we believe that the gospel, the good news of Jesus, doesn't turn you inward, but turns you outward. And you start outreach. You love your neighbor. And then the second thing is, and we believe that all of life is all for Jesus. So there you go. It is all about Jesus as far as we're concerned. And then specifically within our Sunday services, whatever text we're in the Bible, we eventually get to the gospel. And we say, here's where the gospel is in this text and applies to our lives in this text. So there's either implicitly or explicitly a call to Jesus in every single Sunday sermon at every Redemption Church at some point. That's one thing that we need to remember. And then at Arcadia anyway, I don't know necessarily how universal this is, but at Arcadia anyway, even in our liturgy in the service, we tell the story of the gospel through song, prayer, communion, and preaching. So even if I don't do such a good job of sharing the gospel during my sermon, the overarching message of the service through the singing, the prayers, and everything else that we do is pointed towards Jesus and the gospel. So that's what we're trying to do in terms of that.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring up the statistic about people going to church or not going to church. There's another statistic about people who aren't affiliating anymore. But what's really interesting about that set, it's a little misleading, is that churches like Redemption and other Bible-based churches are booming.
Are growing, yes.
Yeah. And traditional denominations are declining.
Right.
They're contracting.
Yeah.
And they're trying to figure out why that is. And I think it has a lot to do with what you just described, and that is the true gospel, speaking of Jesus and not being marred in doctrine or rules or whatever else.
Preferences, which is a big one.
Yeah. Sure.
Sure. Absolutely. I see that happening too. And I get the statistics. And there's part of me that's sad that less than half the people are identifying as Christians now in America. But we knew that was coming too, if you've been watching for the last 30 or 40 years.
Right.
But again, on the other hand, God always works through remnants. If you look in Scripture, he's always working through a minority remnant. And so maybe we're on our way to that so that God can really do something. I met with a guy last week, and he said, I'm waiting now. It feels like there's going to be a revival coming because we're at that point where there's a lot of despair and frustration, which is when God usually works in terms of revival. So
right.
We'll see if that happens too.
How did you get to Redemption? What's your story?
How many episodes did I get to be in?
We'll have you on as many.
I did not grow up in the church at all. And there's so many stories related to that are fascinating. Even the acquisition of our property goes back, in my story, 40 years. I can tie it to somebody I knew 40 years ago in Chicago. And he's related to the person that got me connected to Boots Dunlap and all those guys that got us in to be able to get this property at 33rd Street in Cali. It's just an amazing story how God worked out all that. Anyway.
It's always interesting to go back and connect God's dots.
Yeah.
He's got all these markers.
Fascinating.
And you look back and you're like, oh, that's what was happening.
Yeah. So I didn't grow up in the church. 27 years old, been to church like 4 times in my life. And so I ended up dating a girl who grew up in the church, a woman who grew up in the church, and I started going to church with her, North Phoenix Baptist Church, Central and Bethany Home.
Yep.
Used to drive by it and mock it and make fun of it and all that stuff that non-believers do, thinking, in my arrogance, and started going there, and that's where God saved me. Was at North Phoenix Baptist Church with Richard Jackson preaching. That'll be a name that some of your listeners will go, oh, yeah, I remember him. And so that was while we were still, in the business world, in the public sphere, marketplace, however you want to describe that. And then the company we were working for and leading eventually got sold. And so suddenly I'm 34 years old. I've got a little bit of college, no college degree, a little bit of college. But I've got a brand new worldview. So talked to my wife, Jackie, decided I would go back to school, went to this tiny little liberal arts school in Central Phoenix called Grand Canyon University, got my degree in religious studies with a minor in communication, and then went to Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena. There was an extension here, so I took some of my classes here, but some of them in Pasadena, got my Master of Divinity, and then I applied at ASU. I wanted to get a Master of Arts in Communication Theory and heard that ASU was awesome at that, and they are. The Hugh Downs School has a great worldwide reputation. And somehow got in there and got that degree and started pastoring. I wasn't always going to be a pastor. The idea behind my education was that I wanted to teach college. That's what I wanted to do. But I started to feel like God was pulling me, pushing me, calling me into pastoral ministry. And I resisted and resisted and resisted. And then it was 21 years ago. I'm working at a church part-time, and I'm just starting to teach part-time as well, adjunct. I taught some here, and I just started teaching at Paradise Valley Community College, communication theory. So I taught a number of classes at GCU 25 years ago. I felt God calling me into pastoral ministry, and I was pushing back, pushing back. Finally, I said to God, I made a deal with God. Now is when you laugh.
Yeah, we've all tried to.
Yeah. I said, all right, I'll tell you what. I'll go into pastoral ministry if I never have to do prison ministry, because that sounds really hard, and it sounds like there's no return on investment. And I felt like God had accepted the deal, and I said, all right. So I took this call to be a lead pastor at Paradise Valley Community Church, 42nd Street in Greenway. And 3 months later, between services, lady walks up to me. Her name is Leslie Baranzini. She still lives here in the valley. She said, hey, I just moved down here from the Seattle area. My husband is kind of wrapping things up with his career. He's going to move down here. The reason we moved down here is because our son ended up in prison. He's 19 years old. He's serving 5 years down in Florence. I've been coming here the last couple of weeks. I've decided that I want to be a part of this church, and I want you to start writing my son, and I want you to get cleared by the Arizona Department of Corrections to be clergy for him so that you can do clergy visits with him. And I had this conscious experience of facial management technique, you know, where I was smiling and nodding my head, and internally I'm going, you got to get this woman away from me. You know? So I said, all right, send me all this stuff. I'll figure it out. 6 months later, I'm writing this guy and visiting him in prison. He connects me to a couple of other guys, and they connect me to a couple of other guys. Next thing you know, I'm writing a bunch of guys in prison. I'm going down there and visiting these guys. Next thing you know, I know the chaplain's down there. They're inviting me down to speak and preach and all that stuff. Then I get involved with Collis Huntington, who started a ministry called Alongside Ministries, which is a transition ministry for ex-cons to come out and get trained in re-assimilating. Alongside Ministries is a fascinating transition ministry. The recidivism rate in Arizona is somewhere in the 60s. In other words, reoffending rate, somewhere in the 60%. Alongside ministry, people that go through Alongside Ministries, men and women, the recidivism rate for them is less than 9%.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing.
That's incredible.
And they do it all off of contributions and stuff. No state or federally funded money at all. It's and I've been partnering with them for about 20 years now, doing stuff with them too. So anyway, and then 10 years ago, a guy named Tom Schrader, who's one of our two founding pastors, very well known in the valley, greatest Bible teacher I've ever known in my life, you know, he texted me and said, hey, let's grab coffee. We'd been friends for a long time and knew each other really well, had coffee together a lot, but I knew there was something. I can just tell with Tom. And so I text him back and I said, ooh, mysterious. And he said, I'll tell you when you get here. And so I got there and he said, they had just started Redemption. They had merged East Valley Bible Church in Gilbert and Praxis Church, Justin Anderson's church. And he had Tempe and Arcadia. Arcadia was more of a site. It wasn't really a congregation. And he said, and there was Gateway had joined. So we were four or five congregations at that time. But he said, hey, Justin's leaving, one of the founding pastors, one of the great communicators. He's leaving. He's going to plant a church in San Francisco. So we already know what we're going to do at Redemption Tempe, but we need somebody for Redemption Arcadia. We want to make that a full-fledged congregation now, build infrastructure and all that. I can't offer you the job. I'm too close to you. I'm just here to ask you if you'd be willing to have that conversation. And I said, well, I got to pray about it and talk to Jackie. But inside I'm going, this is amazing. I never thought I'd ever get a chance to work with Tom Schrader. Mm-hmm. So I had kind of already made up my mind. But I went home. Jackie comes home. She didn't even kiss me. She doesn't say hi. She just comes in and she knows something's up. She goes, all right, what did Tom say? And I said, well, he wanted to know if I'd be interested in having a conversation about Redemption Arcadia. And she said, you told him yes, didn't you? And I said, well, I guess we prayed about it. Anyway, so he turned me over to Tyler Johnson, who's our lead pastor over all the congregations, and he spent 10 weeks interviewing. It is the most incredible vetting job I've ever been through in my life. He vetted me like nobody's business. But at the end of the 10 weeks, they said, all right, let's do this, and that's how I came to Arcadia almost, well, 9.5 years ago. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
What... What kind of business stuff did you do prior to getting into the pastoral?
I really loved retail. I'm an old school retail guy. I had jobs. My first really full time job in retail was at Baker Shoes in Christown Mall.
No kidding.
And this was back in the late 70s when Christown Mall was the highest sales per square foot mall in Arizona. Metro had opened and they were doing more total business, but for in terms of sales per square foot, Christown was the place to be. And so I worked there. They eventually moved me to Abilene, Texas to manage a store. And then they moved me to the Chicago area. I spent 5 years in Chicago managing stores for them. Then they moved me to Houston, where I was a regional manager, supervising 19 stores. But the mistake was that they moved me to Houston. I'm not very fond of Houston. So then I came back from Houston, left them, came back, and went to work for, again, historically, some great history in Arizona. Yeah. I worked for the Big Four company, restaurants. So Lee Cohen, Barry Goldstein, all those guys. Worked for them for a while, and then I went into the, I got called into the family business, which was a chain of women's clothing stores. So, and along the way, a little bit of real estate investment and stuff with my dad. So,
how did you, what did you take from the experiences of your business background and retail background? How did that help you, or did you take anything from it as you went into? You know?
I feel like I took a lot. One, an understanding that a church isn't a business, but there are business principles that you need to use and incorporate and be aware of, obviously. But I think the most impactful time was at Paradise Valley Community Church. So 21 years ago, I went to my first elders meeting, and there's agenda for the elders meeting was always the same. Started with prayer, and then there was a little devotion, and then the church treasurer would pass out the previous month's P&L statement. And so they're passing that out, and I didn't get one. And I was like, where's mine, you know? And they were like, the pastor usually leaves during this part. He's not interested, doesn't look at that stuff. I'm like, what are you talking about? Make me a copy. I want to know. And so even then, you know, it was like, it's not that he wasn't, that language too strong. It's not that he wasn't interested. It's just that it wasn't his wheelhouse. Well, I knew how to read financial statements, and I understood that, and I understand trends and stuff like that. And I'm like, no, this is a part of leading and managing the church. I need to see this stuff. And then, you know, pretty soon I started meeting with the church treasurer 2 days before that elder meeting to preview the financial statements, because I thought it was important to read them and know them and even point out where there might be some errors possibly.
Right.
So most pastors go into pastoral ministry having no understanding, no idea how to do any of that kind of stuff. And I think that's a challenge for people. So that's been helpful. That's been an asset to me. I feel like I have some level of understanding of the vernacular of the business world in both real estate and financial advising and all the stuff that you run into in the Arcadia area. So I can pastor and shepherd people while also speaking their language, which I think is important too. I think that's been helpful, but God synchronized all of that. It wasn't me. It wasn't a plan or anything. So,
I just feel like I'm a big believer that God does put you in certain situations, guide you down path that help, as you know, creates building blocks for what you're meant to do. Mm-hmm. Beyond that,
yeah. Are you able to speed up church time?
What does that mean? Speed up church time?
Do you want shorter services? Is that what you're
no? It's what I yeah. what I've learned. So a lot of people don't know this, but after we sold our company 5 years ago, I spent 3 years being the financial advisor for a church down in Tucson, City
that's
Church.
Right.
And the speed at which decisions are made
okay,
in church is much different than in the business world. And I had an elder basically pull me aside and say, this is what we call church time. And I'm like, he goes, you just need to respect the process and that God is in it and eventually we'll get there. I'm like,
yeah.
And actually it was really good for me, mm-hmm. because waiting, of learning mm-hmm. how to wait and learning how to look for mm-hmm. for God's timing in that space.
Yeah. Sure.
Because in the business world, we know where we want to go. Yeah. And my biggest both strength and weakness, it can be weakness, is knowing the answer and thinking everybody else knows the answer and basically telling everybody we're going that way. And then I start going and I look behind around me and nobody's there.
Yeah, right.
We're church time.
Yeah.
Everyone gets there together in a much different way. So I think it's both a good thing, but it can be a hindrance.
So there's, again, that tension on either side. Myself, the staff, we spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week thinking about church stuff. And so when we do make a decision, when we are sure where we want to go, we have to slow down.
Yeah.
Because the assumption is we've put in all the work, we understand what we think needs to happen. Why aren't they up to speed? Well, you got to bring them up to speed. That's really yeah. hard stuff. It is. You have to demonstrate patience and perseverance in the midst of that.
Yeah.
So sure. And there's great wisdom in slowing down, but sometimes you also have to look at something and realize when it's time to, you better move.
Yeah.
You know.
So what it has to do with, you know, new buildings or new things that you know, the church needs.
Yeah. So we have a school that meets that is using our facility during the week. It's called Acton Academy. They're all over the world right now. There's about 250 of them all over the world, and we had the first one in Phoenix, and they're growing like mad now. And so now this is starting to press in terms of we want to keep them there and they want to stay there, but how are we going to figure out how to manage the property so that we can all be there? Because we think it's important also that, you know, a lot of church real estate, unfortunately, is not used at all during the week, and that's
right.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
And so we want to be able to keep doing that.
So you kind of glossed over just a little bit of the family history. Mm-hmm. And that's another point where I think we have a lot in common. We bonded almost instantly. And, I mean, your family is a very iconic family here in Phoenix. I mean, Switzer's Department Stores was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
For three generations.
Yeah.
And talk to us a little bit about the ending of that and how, first of all, how it all came about. I mean, the department store,
yeah.
And how it became one of the most iconic. I mean, along with Goldwaters.
I was going to say Switchers and Goldwaters.
And, yeah, right. Switchers and Goldwaters was like the places to
and,
go.
And Diamonds.
And yeah. Diamonds.
Which was, you know, sold to Dillard's.
Yeah.
So
that was an era that I certainly remember. Mm-hmm. And living here for a time and then being in Tucson as well. I mean, everyone always talked about Switzers.
Yeah.
That it was, there was Goldwaters and Diamonds and there was Switzers.
Yeah.
Sort of, okay.
Yeah.
Reverence. but a family business nonetheless.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And talk a little bit about your time there growing up in it and then how,
yeah.
the ending of it.
So, Switzers was actually a women's specialty store with different departments, but it started in 1917. So yeah. 5 years after, was it 5 years after we became a state?
Yeah.
It was the first women's specialty store in Arizona. 1917 is the same year that JCPenney's got started in Kemmerer, Wyoming, interestingly enough. We didn't end up like JCPenney's. But, so, and it was started by my grandfather. He borrowed $1,500 against his Metropolitan Life insurance policy to start this store in Phoenix. He was working for Bullock's, I believe it was, in Los Angeles as a buyer. Somebody said, you ought to open a store in Phoenix. They don't have a store, and it would be great. So he came over, checked it out, decided to open the store there. My dad was born here, went to Kenilworth grade school, and then eventually they moved back to the Los Angeles area because he had the store in Phoenix, but my grandfather then opened five stores in the Los Angeles area and eventually opened in Tucson too. And then his three sons took over the business, my father in Phoenix, the older brother, Don, down in Tucson, the younger brother, Robert, in Los Angeles. And over the years, Tucson went away, Los Angeles went away, but my father was able to thrive and build a business. And eventually it was, you know, 15 stores across the Southwest. So it was Phoenix, Las Vegas, Reno, Tucson, El Paso, Albuquerque, even Lubbock and San Antonio for a while. And going well. And then my father decided to retire. I took over as CEO, but my father and uncle had the stock.
Yeah,
and we had a board of directors and all that. So we had hired a fairly new operations manager. He'd been around 3 years, and he walked in to my office one day in 1993, fall of 1993, for what he thought was going to be a five-minute conversation. He said, "Hey, some guys from Dress Barn in Stamford, Connecticut called. They had 650 stores nationwide, but nothing in the Southwest." They said, they called and they were wondering if we were interested in selling. And I said, "Well, I guess I better ask, you know, the shareholders, you know." And so we ended up talking about it for 90 minutes. He thought it would be a quick conversation. We talked about it for 90 minutes, talked to my father, who was the majority shareholder, and we had been in business 77 years at that point. He said, "Yeah, let's look at it." And 105 days later, we gave them the keys to the company, and they gave essentially my father and my uncle a check.
Right.
And I worked to shut everything down, including liquidating all of the inventory and all of the, you know, whatever stuff they didn't want. They were really buying us for our leases. We had what's called sweetheart leases. Sure. Leases that had been negotiated decades earlier. This is before, when at the time when you negotiate a 5-year lease and that's it. You know, you had a 25-year lease with a 15-year option at the same rate. It's just goofy. Yeah. You know, we're in Christown Mall for $4 a square foot, yeah, and a cap on common area maintenance. I mean, that's an asset.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they're buying it for, you know. And so we ended up selling, and I shut everything down, including our profit sharing plan. I had to liquidate and distribute all of that. And that was an experience. I learned a lot doing all of that. And at the same time, I was transitioning into school. For that. So that's how Switzers went away after 77 years. I mean, we, you know, when I was there, we were a lot of people don't identify Switzers with this, but we were the number one seller of junior prom dresses in Arizona for most of the major junior prom dress lines in New York. We did a fantastic
that
business.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Huh. So, go back and look at yearbooks from the 70s and 80s, and you see a bunch of Switzers.
All the taffeta and right. Poofy sleeves and everything. Yeah.
What was your? I mean, how old were you when this went down?
I was 34 when I started actually at GCU.
No, but when you were selling,
33, 34.
And so, what were you thinking? Were you thinking that your dad and uncle were nuts, or do you think
no?
You could
not
you
at
could
all.
See,
I had had a change in worldview.
Sure.
So Jackie and I spent a lot of time talking about how this is just God moving us on to what he has for us next. So I was thoroughly committed to kind of stripping everything down as much as we could and going to school.
Yeah.
You know, and my parents helped a lot with that. They were very supportive of that, you know, and it was an interesting time. So I worked hard at school, got jobs speaking at places on the side to earn a little extra money. Jackie was working, and so we made it work somehow, you know. So, but I just figured it was the next step that God had.
Yeah, there was an instant recognition that God was in this.
God was in the midst of this. There's, because, you know, when I had the change of worldview, I'm kind of like, you know, how do we make this so that it's a gospel-centered business and all that? And I guess in his own way, he said, "Well, I'm really going to take you into gospel-centered business," you know. So I guess that's, it was just like riding the wave and being okay with that, you know. It wasn't without its challenges. It's not that it wasn't hard, but it was good.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate to that, you know, very deeply, because when I decided to change my worldview, basically God took me out kicking and screaming. I kept thinking I could change not only the way I was looking at things, but I could change everything. Mm-hmm. And he just said, "No, that's not going to happen."
Yeah.
I'm extracting you, not unfortunately, not only from the business, but also from relationships that were not not healthy.
Yeah.
And you know, brought us up here.
Yeah.
So yeah, I get that. I mean, when God works, I think it goes back to our initial question, right? Mm-hmm. When he works and he's working,
it's, yeah.
You can bargain, right?
Yeah.
You can bargain. You can try to make it about yourself. But if he's working and he's ready and you're ready, it happens very, very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I look back at that time now as everything happened so fast.
Yeah.
And from the moment, I made a firm commitment to follow Jesus, it was 8 months and the company was sold.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was my decision, but it happened.
Yeah.
And then everything that's happened since has been totally his doing.
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea I would end up at Redemption Church.
I had no idea I'd be sitting next to Sean Noble doing a podcast at Grand Canyon University.
I had no idea I'd be on a podcast.
There you go.
Usually I'm on the other side of this. I'm usually the one asking the questions, so this is a kind of a new experience for me. But yeah, I get that. It's just, and there's nothing I would regret about any of it. It's been hard at times, but there's nothing I would regret about I don't have any regrets about it. And neither does Jackie. Interesting thing is, Jackie, God always told Jackie that she would marry a pastor. Mm. And then when we got together, she said, well, I guess I misread that. And then a few years later, she's like, oh, well, there we go.
God fixed it.
And the other thing that's interesting is that I forget to mention often is that God still honored that desire in my heart to teach at the college level. I've been doing that for 22 or 23 years now as an adjunct, as a part-timer, and enjoying it. I've taught at Grand Canyon. I've taught for the Maricopa County District for the last 21 years at PVCC. Been great, wonderful people there. And then I taught at Fuller Seminary, the extension here, for 18 years. But I taught communication. You have to have a PhD if you're going to teach theology at the seminary.
Yeah.
But I taught communication there. So
that's great.
Yeah.
It strikes me that one of the things that I think that people, that you're being guided, but there's a lot of people who resist, right? I mean, they try to figure out, mm-hmm. well, that's not really what God wants me to do, because they start to look more inward instead of outward.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for people who are struggling with trying to hear what God really is trying to tell them?
Well, there's a lot of ways you could go there, but I would zero in on two right away. I mentioned that idea 8 or 10 times in my life where I really felt like God was speaking directly to me. It was the Holy Spirit pointing me in some direction. And I hear a lot of people say, well, the Spirit is telling me to do this. And I'm like, well, what is it? And then you find out it's really something that they really want to do. And it's probably not that biblical.
Right.
But it's the Holy Spirit.
But, but it's called God.
My experience with when I felt like the Spirit was telling me something or leading me in some way, two things. One, it doesn't contradict anything in the Bible. And two, it's nothing that I came up with or anything that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good indication, because my flesh wants to go somewhere else always. And I got all kinds of stories about, you know, those 8 or 10 times, but they're all like that. They're all like, I'd rather go do something else or think about something in a different way. The other one is we're going to do Nehemiah this summer. We're going to take a break from the Gospel of John and do Nehemiah, Old Testament book, for 9 weeks. And the thing that keeps striking me about Nehemiah is talk about church time. In chapter 1, when he is told of the problem in Jerusalem, 1,100 miles away, and he is broken over the problems in Jerusalem for his people, he doesn't say anything about it for 4 months. He prays for 4 months. He waited. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I, we'd be like, boom, we got to go do something, you know? He waited. The first thing he started doing was praying, and he waited, and he waited, and he waited, and then God opened that door for him with Artaxerxes, a king. When the king went to him, Nehemiah was his cupbearer, and he said, why are you so downcast today? You know, And that opened the door for Nehemiah to say, hey, this is what's going on. And Artaxerxes says, well, let me help you. You know, and so Nehemiah, I'm sure, is going, well, that would be God doing that. But he waited. You know, he was patient and he prayed. And if you go through the rest of the book of Nehemiah, the guy is constantly praying first before he does anything. You know, it's amazing. There's a sense in which in chapter 4 where there's opposition to Nehemiah, I kind of liken him to Jack Reacher, you know? Okay. Now, Nehemiah was always, you know, hoping for the best, preparing for the worst, and didn't do anything if he didn't think he was going to win, so.
Right. Okay, now I'm going to think of Nehemiah looking like Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Wouldn't go that far.
Yeah, right.
Jack Reacher. You never know.
No, I think you're right. I think... The patience to look where God is leading you. And I said it earlier, connecting the dots. Yeah. You can always look back and see, okay, well, this led me to this point, this led me to this point. And kind of know that despite your negotiations with God, whatever that might look like, he's going to be pushing you in the direction that he wants. I mean, your prison ministry is a perfect example of that. And, me sitting here with Sean Noble and Grand Canyon University doing a podcast, yeah, and doing some interesting things here that I would never thought,
yeah,
5 years ago, unwinding a business and then moving along that I would, you know, be in the space, and so I think one of the answers is just hold on because God's working.
Yeah, right. I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think patience, the example of Nehemiah is a good one. I think that is something that, I mean, especially in this day and age, there is no patience anymore. No. Mm-hmm. People want instant answers. And I think one of the ways that it's been evident in my life is, you know, I'll seek an answer for something and realize I've got to really spend some time praying, being introspective, really just sitting still and letting my mind grasp
right
what it is that I should be doing.
Yeah.
So,
but you're right. We live in a culture where inactivity means you're not doing anything. You're not being productive. Tom used to say all the time that if you get caught thinking at work, people will say, well, we're not paying you to think. Well, that's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, there are times when the most productive time I have is when I can slow down, like going just walking in the mountain preserves, you know, for an hour, and I'm able to think and pray about things and sort things out, you know. That can be some of the most productive time that I have.
So as you can tell, we just had a technical difficulty with Frank's podcast. I think we figured it out.
I'm blaming the mics. I'm blaming the mics and these things because I had a hard time like trying to figure out where this was supposed to be, where this was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Because I'm used to like this big, large
right
deal.
But it's probably fortuitous because we're now a couple weeks from when we taped Frank.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, my wife, who's pregnant, has been having some complications. And the timing of this has been remarkable because as you just listened to, you know, talk about bargaining with God, and on that Saturday when she was bleeding and in the hospital and I didn't know what was going on, I found myself bargaining with God. Mm-hmm. And it was so powerful to have had the conversation with Frank and with you days before that happened. And then to just have that calm feeling of knowing, hey, everything's going to be fine because it's in God's hands. And I'm certain that I would not have been as calm and as at peace knowing everything was going to be fine had we not had that conversation a few days before. It's just one of those things where I see God's hand.
Well, I have this saying that sometimes God just walks in the room and gives you precisely what you need when you need it. Not that he's always with you and in control, But one of the hardest things, lessons I had to learn while we were selling our family company was that truth, that God is in it, and waiting on God is sometimes the hardest thing.
Yeah.
This whole idea of waiting on God. We're an impatient people. We want things when we want them. And interestingly enough, the church that Sasha and I go to, Scottsdale Bible, the sermon this weekend was on precisely that, on God's provision during times of doubt and uncertainty. And the sermon was on John 21, where the disciples are up in the Sea of Galilee, and Peter decides he's going fishing. Now, my read of that is totally different than most people's. My read of it is Peter is sort of like, what is going on? I have no clue what's happening. I don't know where I am in all this, having already betrayed my Lord. And he says to his best buddies, I'm going fishing. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Checking out.
I'm checking out. And they say, we're going with you. They could have said, okay, great. Have a good time. We're going with you. And they go out, of course, and the story goes, they catch nothing. But then this figure on the shore says, hey, put your nets over to the right side of the boat. And they bring in 153 fish. And so the idea is, I mean, that by pursuing Jesus, by pursuing him and him only, he provides, right?
Right.
And that was so much of what Frank was talking about.
Absolutely. So it was a wonderful episode. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll have more of those types to come as well.
Absolutely.
In addition to the politics and the dark money and the light beer. We're going to have a light beer conversation.
Yeah. I think we can announce that. We're working on actually having some guests who will talk about dark money and light beer. Not exactly in the same episode.
Right. But people that are beyond... All right, well, you're pretty expert, I'm pretty expert, but there's additional viewpoints.
Yes.
We're going to have, right?
Yeah.
So I have a viewpoint on dark money. We're going to bring someone who has a different viewpoint.
Yeah.
And you have
I'm going to bring in a gentleman, hopefully, who is my biggest competitor in the state and who became a great friend of mine.
Fascinating.
So it'll be fun.
That will be fun. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.